So this morning I wanted to tell a story. It's one of these stories that works kind of like myth or mythology, where you're supposed to find yourself in the story, and maybe all the characters of the story. Trouble hearing? And I'll tell you another story first, as a preparation for the main story. At the time of the Buddha, there was a party in a grove of trees in a little park, pleasure park, and all these noble wives and husbands came to frolic in the park. And one of the young noblemen didn't have a wife, so he came along with a woman of ill repute, and so they all played happily together, frolicked in the park, and then it was time for the siesta. And so they all took a nap, and now the woman of ill repute saw this as a wonderful opportunity to gather together all the jewelry that everyone had brought with them to the party. And when everyone woke up from their naps, they found that their jewelry was gone, and so was this woman. So the young noble men then went chasing after, looking for this woman, and to get their jewelry back. And they came across the Buddha, who happened to be living in this particular park and at the time. And they came across, he was probably meditating underneath a tree. And they came by him and they said, "Hey, have you seen a woman?" The Buddha said, "What would you rather find, a woman or yourself?" And this caught their attention, at least of the men in the party. And they sat down and listened to what he had to teach, and it transformed their lives. So the idea of finding oneself. So what is it to find oneself? What is it to pursue something outside of oneself? And when is it that these kind of pursuits maybe are they go in counter purposes to each other? So the story is from very famous story from China, and I don't know the Chinese name of this woman, but in Japanese her name is pronounced Senjo. And Senjo was raised in a household where the mother had died, and so she was raised by her father, and she had an older sister who also died. So she was being raised by her father, and she was the only daughter, only child. And when she was quite young, she played often with her father's nephew, and they made a wonderful playmates together. And people would joke, "Oh, these two are made for each other, and certainly when they grow up, they'll get married." It was kind of like a joke. But the two of them, as children, took this to be serious and always assumed that was the case, that they would grow up and get married. And in fact, as they were growing up, they fell deeply in love with each other. And then, however, the father had other ideas in mind. And when she became of age to be married, he found she was very beautiful and had a lot of suitors. She was very popular. And the father chose among one of the more successful, wealthy suitors, that person would be good to be your husband. And so it was arranged marriage. And when the young nephew, who had always thought that he was going to be to marry Senjo, when he heard about this, he was quite distraught and didn't feel like he could live in the village anymore. And so in the middle of one night, he stole off and went down to the river and took a boat upriver. Now you can imagine that Senjo also was quite distressed that she was learning she was going to marry someone she didn't really know and was not going to marry the person she deeply loved. So the nephew ran off up the river, and at midnight, in the darkness of the night, he saw running along the riverbank a vague figure. And so he stopped to see who it was. And to his great delight, it was Senjo. His true love was there, and she had gotten wind of the fact that he was running away from his pain, and that she was going to go with him. And they embraced and kissed, and they were both very happy, and they went off to another country, upriver. And there they lived for 5 years, and they lived quite happily for the most part, and they had two children. And after 5 years of this kind of life, Senjo missed very much her home village and missed her father, and felt very bad about leaving him, and really wanted to go back. And they felt that it was kind of problematic, because certainly the father would be quite angry at both of them, and certainly at the nephew, and there'd be serious repercussions for having kind of eloped. But after a while, the strong pull and the wish to be back home became strong enough that for Senjo, that her husband said, "Well, let's go back, and maybe if we ask for forgiveness, maybe your father will forgive us, and when he sees our wonderful children, everything will be fine." So they went back to the village, and there in the village, they arrived at the riverbank, at the edge of the river. The nephew said to Senjo, "Won't you wait here, and I'll go back and talk to your father and ask for his forgiveness." So he went back and knocked at the door, and the father opened the door, and he was surprised to see the nephew, and the nephew said, "I'm here to apologize for having run off with your daughter, and I want to tell you that we've lived happily together 5 years, and we've been somewhat successful in our endeavors in another country, and now we have two wonderful children, and we would like to come back and ask for your forgiveness and see if we can live here." And the father says, "I don't know what you're talking about. I know that you went away, and it was a sad day when you left our village, and especially since the day that you left, Senjo has taken to her room in my house, and she hasn't spoken to anyone since. And she lives in a kind of a numb stupor in the room, and she barely eats. And she's been there. She hasn't left the room in 5 years and hasn't spoken to anyone. I don't know what you're talking about, her going off with you." And so the nephew is quite confused, or a little bit confused, and said, "What's going on here?" And says, "Well, please come down with me to the village, to the riverbank, where at the boat Senjo is waiting to meet you." And so the father sends a servant down to the river to find out what's going on. And in the meantime, he goes into the bedroom where Senjo has been laying there for 5 years, and explained to her that strange occurrence, that this nephew has come back, and he claims that she is, in fact, down by the river, and she has two children, and is quite happy. And then the first time in 5 years, Senjo gets out of the bed, and walks out of the bedroom and out of the house and into the street. And at that time, the Senjos down by the river is walking up the river towards the house. And the two Senjos see each other, and they walk together, and they merge, and they become one Senjo. And then the father says, "Oh, now I understand. The real Senjo stayed here, but your soul, who was so connected to my nephew, ran off with him to live with him, and now the real Senjo and her soul have joined together." And then Senjo says, "I don't know which one of me was real. Maybe both of me was real, but now we've come back together." So that's the story. And in the Zen tradition, this story is used as a koan, a kind of a question which the student will carry with them. And the particular question that the student carries with them is, which is the real Senjo? The one who went up the river, and the one who stayed at, or the one who stayed at home? So what do you think? Sorry? Both of them? Which is the real Senjo? The one who had the children. What do you think? Anyone else? Other options? Neither of them? There's actually three senjos in the story. Three to choose from. The one who came back together? So I thought it was a very interesting story. Because I think it happens to many of us, is that we, in some ways, split off from ourselves. And there's many reasons for that. Sometimes it's our aspirations. We have something we love and something we really wish to do, and it doesn't go along with some other part of us. In this story, it's the social, in a sense, perhaps the social obligation of being a good daughter in Chinese family, or perhaps it's the love of being in her village, or these two loves were at odds, in a sense. And so she felt split, and she chose one over the other, and off she went. And so sometimes it's some great aspiration. We have a great love we want to follow, we have a career we want to follow, a job, a schooling. We have something that we want to pursue, but we maybe feel that it entails some cost, leaving something behind. Or perhaps we don't choose our aspirations, our hopes, our wishes, our love, but we choose to let go of that, leave it behind, in favor of staying home, staying with the obligation, staying with the status quo, staying with our responsibilities, or staying with the wishes of people around us, our family, our parents, our children, or whatever it might be. And then again, some part of us doesn't get fed or get followed through on because we stay at home. And I think that this kind of dilemma of having to choose between two choices is particularly strong in our modern society. My impression is that our modern society offers human beings more choices than any society has ever made in human history. And I guess the cliche is, which pack of cigarettes to buy. There's so many choices, but there's choices left and right that people have to make. It wasn't so long ago that people really didn't have a choice about what kind of career they followed in their lives or who they married. These things were basically, they were born into it. It was given that if your parents were farmers, you were going to farm. If your parents were whatever else, you were going to do the same thing. So we have these very, very deep and very important choices that we have to make in our lives. And many people aren't really prepared to make these kinds of choices, and certainly not the number of choices we have to make. And often choices entail a cost. Sometimes maybe the myth is that if we really know who we really are and what our real wishes are, that we'll know what we want to do and we'll just follow that. We'll follow our heart's wish and never look back. But I think to some degree there's often some splitting off of ourselves. So we have to choose one over the other and something is left behind. And so the question is, who is the real self? Who really are we? Are we the one who follows our aspirations, our love, follows our bliss, follows our desires? Or are we the one who follows our responsibility or follows the social context that we live in and what society tells us we should do? And we had a number of suggestions already. The first one was maybe it's both. Many of us will choose one aspect of who we are as this is who I am. We say, well, my hopes, my aspirations, my desires, my wishes, that's really much more integral to who I am, and I choose that part. And other people will choose, especially in different cultures, will choose our social self, the sense of social obligation, our responsibility, and that's actually much more central to who we are than our wishes and our aspirations. In my own experience now being a parent, is to watch how this kind of plays out in my own life, because it's very clear to me that as a parent of a young child, that in a sense, part of who I am now is my responsibility for my child, and that takes precedence over that part of me which, when I was younger, I used to associate or identify more strongly with was my own personal wishes and desires and be able to go off and travel around the world or whatever. I used to do. So the choices we have to make, and what are the costs? What are the consequences of choosing one over the other? I read recently that Freud distinguished between, I think the expression in the book I read was real suffering, a true suffering, and false suffering. And false suffering entailed the kind of suffering that arises when we put up resistance to feeling the tensions of our life, the real conflicts and tensions of our life. So if there is a tension between, in Senjo's life, between going off with her lover and staying home with her father, there's a certain kind of pain there, I would imagine. And if a person feels, well, I'm not going to be present for that pain, and puts up resistance to it, goes off to some other country far away, lives there for 5 years, and then starts feeling the ache and the sorrow of being separated from her father also, and then says, well, you know, I'm not going to, you know, then starts kind of defending herself against that, and starts being deciding, well, all the reasons why her father was a terrible person, and it's really a way of defending herself from her own sense of pain and conflict. And so the suffering that arises out of that defense and out of that kind of criticism of her father, whatever she comes up with, perhaps Freud would have called a false suffering. And that true suffering would be to really be present there for the tension itself, for what was she actually feeling. And I think that's what I think mindfulness practice is helping us to do, is to the degree to which we do have suffering out of conflict, is to not set up kind of a false suffering that is removed from the core suffering that kind of defends it and criticizes it, whatever we do, but allows us to let go into the actual source of the tension. And in the story, in a sense, the healing of Senjo is kind of like a fairy tale, because the two Senjos who lived separate from each other came together in the village, and where supposedly they live happily ever after. But I don't know if it's always so easy for us to heal the separate parts of us. But part of meditation practice is to bring them together. And in that bringing together, maybe it doesn't resolve the worldly differences. It doesn't mean that we get to have all our choices fulfilled, all the different options. But rather, there is some kind of healing that's possible in each of us, some kind of wholeness that's possible, that's not possible if we're simply always pursuing one or the other options. I've also read that in, I don't know if it's true, but I've read that in Greek myths, that often the downfall of a hero, the great heroes of, or the great gods, the stories, is not the heroes or heroines' failings or shortcomings, but rather is the aspiration of the hero or heroine. That the person is pursuing something and the person thinks that they can be greatly successful, a certain kind of hubris. And in that hubris of aspiration and thinking they can pursue things, that itself they overextend and overreach themselves. That somehow our aspiration, which is a very important part of us, lends itself very easily to us overextending ourselves and then losing ourselves in the process. And this, I think, is very true in spiritual practice, and certainly it was true in my own spiritual practice, and especially in my early years, that I had great aspiration in my practice, great wish, great intentions, and there were times where I pursued that blindly, where I pursued that with certain kind of hubris, certain kind of dedication, where I shut myself off from other parts of who I was. And the very attempt to kind of pursue a spiritual life was maybe blind, was maybe too idealistic, was an attempt to pursue some kind of purity, some kind of ideal of who I thought I could be or who I was or what I thought spiritual life was, that blinded me to other parts of myself. It was like I was pursuing going after the lover and forgetting there are other parts of who I was. And that's certainly possible with spiritual practice also. But sooner or later, I think in spiritual practice, a person will very clearly feel the tension of that split or that pull. And that's what happened to me also. Very painfully, I felt that the tension, I was kind of way ahead of myself into some ideal, and which was very fragile, and it didn't really work. Part of the advantages of throwing yourself into spiritual practice in a kind of gung-ho way is that you run up against the limitations of your aspiration sooner rather than later. Some people who don't throw themselves seriously enough into the spiritual practice can spend a lifetime kind of dabbling on the edges and never really see the shortcomings of their way in which they're engaged. But sometimes throwing yourself fully into it, sooner or later your face goes up against the wall. So in terms of mindfulness practice, and that becomes very important, I believe, that at some points in our practice that we allow ourselves to sit with our tensions. We allow ourselves to sit with the conflicts within us. We allow ourselves to sit with that which is unresolved within us, rather than always kind of going after following our bliss, as Campbell encouraged us to do, or rather than always following our suffering, which is in a sense a little bit more what the Buddha encouraged people to do. In a sense, is to sit in the tension between them, to be willing to be someone who has conflict, to have different aspects of our life, and to sit there, and then to sit right in the middle of that tension, I found, often brings a resolution, brings a kind of, I don't know if it's the right expression, but maybe it's the wrong expression, but kind of a dialectical synthesis of these, a third possibility that doesn't exist as long as we stay in either or kind of camp. So in terms of, you know, which is the real Senjo, my feeling would be is that all three are the real Senjo. And to assume that one is not the real Senjo is to do her a disservice, to ourselves a disservice. So the one who went off with her lovers is the real Senjo, absolutely. The one who stayed home is the real Senjo. And the one that, you know, was the combination of both was the real one. And so how do we embrace all these aspects of ourselves? How do we allow ourselves to be these desperate parts, and how do we bring them together? And then I'll end with a quote from the Zen master Dogen. He said, when you are not yet filled with the Dharma, when you're not yet filled with the truth, then you could all too easily think that things are sufficient, that things are perfect as they are. But when you are filled with the Dharma, when you're filled with the truth, then you know that things are not quite perfect. So I thought that was a kind of beautiful thing. So the closer we get to the truth, the more we maybe feel that something is always a little bit off. So how do we live in a life where things are always going to be a little bit off? Do we want to? Maybe not. Maybe you'd rather not. Maybe you'd rather find a spiritual tradition that says everything is just fine. But here you've came to Buddhism and it says everything's always a little bit off. I mean, is that good news? So I think that's good news, because it's in the realistic assessment of that we find our freedom and our love and our peace. Because ultimately the purpose of Buddhism is to find those, is to find our peace, our liberation, and our love. So those are my thoughts for today. I thought, since this is a koan that you're supposed to grapple with and see, and that it might be nice if you divide it up into little groups here today, maybe groups of three or four, and try if you can. This is dangerous for me to say, because then I'm telling you to choose one Senjo over the other. Try not to come up with the simplest or the simple answer that you can, but really grapple with this question together, little groups. Maybe you have your answer of who you think the real Senjo is. But don't just kind of say it kind of lightly or kind of simply, but really kind of get underneath there and try to explain why you really think that's the case or why you think maybe it doesn't work. So if you're willing, we have quite a bit of time left. Why don't you, we take maybe about 10 minutes or so, and you just divide up into groups of three or four, and take turns just speaking about this famous story of Senjo and see what you come up with. And then in some time, either when I feel like the energy is dropping or after about 10 minutes, I'll ring the bell, and then we can sit quietly for a few moments and then have a few reflections about what came up in your discussions, and then we can end the evening and end the morning at the usual time. Is it okay? Good, please. Quietly for a couple of minutes, a minute or so. So maybe we have a couple of minutes if someone would like to say something about the insights they had in having those conversations, or what it was like to hear from others, or what your reactions were to the story, talking about it. Thank you. Yes.
I was mentioning in my group, the reminder for me that life is really lived in gray. It's really not about black and white. And I think that as human beings are complex and multidimensional, we have a lot of needs and wants that not only change, you know, from moment to moment, but over time. And there's the things I wanted when I was younger. I'm no longer on the work to me and pursuing other things, but I thought, oh my gosh, I'm just getting old. You know, and so it is about the brain and living with the questions more than knowing the answers.
Thank you. Please.
What was most interesting to me about your story and what I reflected on it myself afterwards was and I'll use my own analogy to demonstrate this, is the conflict that I've had throughout my life in between a career and reaching financial security and my family on the other hand, and as my family grew up, then not being there in a, like the woman was in the home, in a completely appropriate caring, nurturing way for my family, and yet at the same time dealing with the other part of my life, and the consequences at the end that you didn't go into of whenever she's reemerged, or whenever we as people try to reemerge our life as we become older, those conflicts can be very difficult to get through. And it's not the fact that we may want to merge and we may see the differences and difficulties that have occurred, but yet having that happen is very difficult sometimes. You didn't talk about it. About both sides of the her lives as she came in.
And grief. Great, thank you.
One reflection I had on the story was Denjo, who commuted back and forth in the story, she was either in the bedroom, unconscious, or presumably happier, or whatever, at the other village with her family. And I tried to find another angle on the story, and one would be where she, in a modern term, maybe commuted back and forth. My story is a person who was really almost on a daily basis, but certainly on a frequent basis, from the bedroom to the village, and went back to the bedroom and to the village, you know, on a certain frequent basis. But I guess you have high speed travel on those days.
Great, thank you.
Something that's real, is it real, or does it go away as soon as I identify, oh, that's it? So that was interesting.
Well, very good. Thank you. Please.
It became apparent in our discussion that people, I can't talk about the real Sancho in some kind of an isolated way. She's really defined in some way or created by her relationships. So there's a real Sancho who loves the nephew and goes off and has a family. And there's also a real Sancho who's got a very strong relationship with her father, who probably brought her up and all of that. And, so there's sort of two different people depending or defined by the relationships and the love they have. The sad part of this is that the one who stayed home was so passive, she didn't assert herself to anybody. Stayed in the bedroom for 5 years.
Thank you. Well, that was great. So, thank you all for participating, and I look forward to see which Sancho comes next week, which one you bring along.